Greetings and welcome to Inside Baseball with Old Chestnut. I am your host, Liam Allen. Today we are delighted to have none other than Morris Sachs, the headline act in our show, joining us for the first time. Good to have you today, Morris.
Well, it's good to be had, Liam. Happy Sunday.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to finally do this. And I'd like to give our listeners a little bit of a background on you for those who don't know. The Reader's Digest version will give a little bit of your history growing up in Chicago, your move to New York, and then your illustrious career. So you just turned 60 this past August.
I did, yeah. Thanks for reminding me.
You're welcome. And I believe that was the day that, gold hit the high of the year.
Yeah, exactly. August 6th, I think.
And it's been downhill since.
As I like to say, it's been 8 pounds of shit in a 4 pound bag.
Amazing. Yeah. So let's start in Chicago. You're from Chicago, Richard Daley, Chicago.
Yes.
And you made your first trade as a teenager. Can you walk me through that?
I'll try and give you the Reader's Digest version on this stuff because, it's only mildly interesting to people. But my cousin, who's about 20 years older than me, was a stockbroker at Merrill Lynch at the time. And I was 10 or 11 years old, and I was fascinated by the idea of being able to make money by picking things out of the paper and buying them, and if they went up, making money off of it. So I asked them a bunch of questions all the time. And one day I decided, well, I like to go bowling with my family. So that was obviously a good business. So I called up my cousin, Henry, and I said I wanted to buy some stock in the Bowling Corporation. There began my illustrious trading career. I ended up being 0-for-1. Everyone's got to start somewhere. And so that was it. And I bebop-booped around with the stuff till I became a teenager. And I read a book called How to Buy Stocks by Lewis Engel. And that was a book that was put out by like Merrill Lynch stockbrokers for their clients to learn about the market. So 16, 17, 18, I gained some interest in this stuff. The local country club that my parents belonged to had a number of men who were traders at the Chicago Board of Trade, where they traded at that point mostly agricultural commodities. And these guys were cool and fun, and they had great stories, and they had pretty wives and fast cars. And so it all seemed to come together for me. And I had some summer jobs over the next few years down on LaSalle Street, which is the Wall Street equivalent in Chicago. And basically at that point I was hooked. I spent time working for my cousin Henry, who was a stockbroker but had his own firm by that time, doing some research. And then I had a couple of summers at the Chicago Board of Trade being a runner at the I started in the grain room with soybeans, wheat, oats, corn. And then moved over to the bond room where they traded treasury bond futures. One thing that my family, my mother was very in particular about, was pointing out that I had to get a college education and something that I could make sure I got a job in. And so I majored in accounting, which was good because I tell people all the time I'm terrible with math. And ask any one of my kids or my wife, and they'll confirm that. But the good thing about a business in most instances is the math is easy, and I can add, subtract, multiply, and divide with the best of them. So 4 years of undergrad at University of Illinois, stayed an extra year and got a master's and ended up, you know, enjoying that extra year. I had met my wife freshman year, and we were together, you know, through all of college and graduate school. And so we both left the University of Illinois in 1983. She went to work for a public accounting firm. I want to say it was Price Waterhouse, but I don't remember exactly. Okay. And I took a job at the bond department at the Continental Bank in Chicago.
Okay.
So that gets us up to 1983. In 1983, the bank had some problems. They kind of went broke, actually. It was one of one of the biggest banking crises of the modern era. And I was sort of in the middle of it and got to see it all. And so, you know, that saying, God closes one door and opens another. The bank was in trouble. So all of the senior traders up and left and got better jobs. And because of that, an opening developed on the trading desk, which I at probably at this point might have been 24, 23 or 24, which was kind of young to get a trading desk on a money center trading desk, a government trading desk. And after a brief period of time, I was able to work my way into a job on Wall Street. And so we moved to New York, 1985, I think it was. And from there, you know, just kind of one thing led to another. And, you know, probably sometime around the year 2010, I probably met you on the Gimbel's ride. And, yep. You know, the rest is history.
Right.
As they
right.
say.
Yeah, you were somebody. I was nobody. I wanted to hang out with the cool kids, and we you know, fell together.
I think that might have been the first time I've ever been described as the cool kid, so I'll take it. But yeah, I think we hit it off, and you know, I've admired your work ethic and you know, your intelligence and kind of always optimistic approach to things, and you've been very respectful of my time, and it's always been a lot of fun hanging out with you.
Great, and I nagged you enough, and here we are.
Here we are. So
that being yeah. said, let me just thank Kevin Muir for being the first domino that fell that got us here, because I don't think if you didn't talk to Kevin Muir and go on his podcast, I don't think I would have been able to grease the wheels to get you to do this. So I just want to thank him for the role that he played in this.
He's an interesting kid. And as he pointed out at some point, kid is relative, right?
Of course.
Because I call you a kid, yet I don't think you feel of yourself that way. But a good friend of mine, and I've discovered that in most instances, people prefer I omit their names. Not in Kevin's case, because obviously he's a promoter. Sure. So a good friend of mine recommended Kevin's blog. I think it's called The Macro Tourist.
Yep.
And I started reading this thing. You know, as you know, I read a lot of financial information. And I figured out this kid knows his shit. And he presents it in a way, such a funny, self-deprecating way that, you know, you just want to hug him. I mean, he's just got such a great attitude. Plus, you know, he's got that Canadian way about him.
And that warmth.
Yeah. And so, like with many of these things, I made comments on his blog, and he was always – had a witty response. And at one point, I think I maybe suggested we chat on the phone or something. Well, we just hit it off, you know. It's kind of a guy like you, you know. If you can't have a conversation with Kevin or can't have a conversation with Liam, well, you know.
You're the problem.
Move along.
Right.
But Kevin asked me if I wanted to be on his podcast, right? Yep. And I told him, no, you know, that's not really my thing. I like to talk to people I know about financial stuff, and I especially like to talk to people I like about, you know, markets and ways to understand finance and those things. But, you know, going out and being on the sort of the public view, as it were, didn't really interest me much. But I was talking to another friend of mine, you know, my Mike and the Mad Dog friend.
Of course.
And he said, you know, what do you got to lose? And so I went on with Kevin and, you know, with my iPhone, and the quality was terrible. And it was hard because, you know, I'm talking to a dead screen, right? I can't see Kevin. And so it was a funny sort of thing, but I had a more detailed explanation of how I got my start. But I found I had a lot of fun with it. And, you know, what I was more surprised with was people who listened actually found it interesting, which,
yep.
You know, is a little,
yep.
It's a little bit of a surprise. And I guess to fast forward, I just had my fourth chat with him, you know, on the, what do they call it? The market huddle.
Yep.
And I went out and there were some slides and you know, the whole
yep.
thing. So,
yep.
So when you were itching to give this a try, I figured, you know, first of all, you and I can sit around and talk forever, right?
Yep.
And maybe, you know, something will come of this where if there's some questions or things you've seen in the market or investing that you don't understand or want to talk about, I could try and answer them. And maybe if the questions you have, other people may have, maybe they'll find that as some value. And if we give it a try and after several weeks, you get bored with it, I get bored with it, Amy tells you to quit screwing around talking to Morris, or people send us hate mail, then fuck it. What do we lose, you know?
Agreed. So, right. Nobody's listening, so we don't have to worry about it. That's my thought.
Well, you know, the NSA is listening, but they're listening anyway, so.
Yeah, the keywords they're listening for is Bitcoin, tax, crypto. Yeah. Check all those boxes.
Improvised explosive device.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Child pornography.
Y'all Qaeda. Yeah, exactly.
It's like that the terrorist wife said to the terrorist, does this bomb make my ass look fat?
Right. Right.
Sorry. Sorry. No, but I digress.
So let's go back. So you're on Wall Street in 1983, 1986, and those were good times for Wall Street, correct? That was a good time to be there? Personally?
There's that saying, you know, when the good times are good, they're really, really good, and when the times are bad, they're really not that bad.
Right.
It's never a bad time to be on Wall Street, ever.
Right.
Ever. But, you know, I got there around the time that, you know, sort of the movie Wall Street came out and the,
of course.
And fancy restaurants, limousines, you know.
And you're a kid. You're 27.
Oh, yeah. Even a little younger. Yeah. 25 right. probably. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've told me that if it weren't for your wife keeping you grounded, it was the devil's playground at that time.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah. Well, you think of it like this. So on an active day, I would probably pay $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 of commissions to the wow. brokers.
Yep.
And that was every day. And I wasn't the big trader.
Yep.
Right. So if they took you out to a fancy restaurant and spent $200, $300, it didn't matter. If they gave you tickets to a Broadway show that was $400, it didn't matter. If, you know, and
yeah, they put you in the limo and took you up to the Springsteen show.
They did, in fact, yes, put me in a limousine at 20 Broad Street and drove me up to Providence, Rhode Island to see Bruce Springsteen. Yes.
Yep.
For free. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Those are the good old days.
Yes. And for those of you listening at home, I made that offhand comment to Liam a zillion years ago, and you fact-checked me, right?
I did. I did. I wanted to see the show, and lo and behold, in the 21st century, I could type in Springsteen, Providence, and the year. And by the time Morris was home for dinner, I had emailed him the YouTube clip of the boss at in Providence.
Yeah. So you were operating under the trust but verify?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This guy's full of shit. No way. Yeah. I know. It's okay. It's okay. Love you.
So you're at what firm in the late 80s? Where are you?
Well,
if you don't mind me asking.
No, I don't. I'm happy. You can ask me anything. It doesn't mean answer it.
Yep.
So when I came to New York, let's call it 1984, I joined a firm called Arbor G. Lanston & Company, which was one of the primary dealers in government securities. It was an old line, kind of blue blood bond house. Okay. And it was owned by the Eccles family of Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah. And why Eccles is an interesting name is because, and you can fact check me on this, but go with me. The Federal Reserve Building in Washington is the Mariner Eccles Building, same family.
Okay.
So Aubrey G. Lanston was head of government bonds at First Boston Corporation. He connected with the Eccles family, and lo and behold, they became a primary dealer back in, it was probably, I'm guessing, the 1950s.
Okay.
So Aubrey G. Lanston always had a very close relationship with the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
And so being a kid of 24, 25, I had a lot of introductions to people at the Fed that, you know, people just don't normally get, right?
Yep.
So that was kind of a unique experience for me. And I was there for about 4 years making prices for clients, you know, whether mm-hmm. they wanted to buy or sell, I gave them a price. But I could tell the dynamic in the market was changing, that if I wanted to have a long career, I needed to find a way to be self-supporting, meaning I didn't want to rely on clients coming in to buy and sell. I wanted to be able to learn how to make money on my own. And yep. and nowadays they call that proprietary trading.
Sure.
So there was a French grain company up in Stamford, Connecticut, named Louis Dreyfus Corporation.
Okay, yeah.
And all they did was trade for their own account. No clients, just the family's capital.
Yep, a family shop.
Yes. So I found a way to get a job there, and Cheryl and I moved up to Coscob, which is part of Greenwich, in 1987. I remember specifically 87 because we moved in July, and then in October you had the 87 stock crash.
Okay.
And I was only at Louis Dreyfus for a little over a year. I didn't get on well there with them, and I moved along pretty quick. But, you know, I learned a great deal from them. And so we parted company, and I ended up going to work for the Deutsche Bank.
Okay.
From, let's say, 1988 to 1992. And I was a proprietary trader there. Once again, just trading the bank's capital. Didn't have anything to do with the clients of the bank. And, you know, I was commuting every day. So, you know, I was getting up at like 4:30 and I was catching the 5:30 milk run into the city and at my desk by 7. And,
yep.
and in 89, we had our first child. And so the commute was a little bit daunting. And at the same time, you know, I was getting to be more successful trading bigger positions. And there was a firm in Connecticut at the time called Greenwich Capital, where you had a lot of young, aggressive, smart guys were going to, and they had a very competitive compensation structure. And then the commute would only be 10 minutes for me. So I was able to wangle a job in there. Once again, same thing, proprietary trading. And I ended up being there for, I think, 16 years,
yep.
which is in Wall Street terms, it's like dog years, you know.
Yeah, an eternity.
Yeah.
Yep.
And So I think 08, 09, I left there and did a stint at one hedge fund for a brief period of time. It might have been 6 months. That didn't go great. And then because I wasn't really interested in ending my career that way, I went with two of my younger colleagues and set up a hedge fund called 515 Capital Management, where I think we were in business for 4 years, maybe. You know, I'm not really great with these dates, but, you know, we started with $50 million of investor money. And at one point, I think we had close to $1 billion, which, you know, 2010, 2011,
Was that significantly different than working proprietary trading when you were running other people's money at the hedge fund?
It's a whole nother ball of wax. The hedge fund business is entirely different than working for everyone's a bank now, right? I mean, they're all banks. But yeah, it's running other people's money is it's a whole nother thing. And I'm not cut out for it personally. You know, I kind of like to have my own capital on the line. And, you know, I don't mind talking to people when they have questions, but, you know, I like to choose the time and the place.
Of course.
I don't want to get the incoming call asking about what happened on a run-of-the-mill Tuesday. Anyway, the end of the 515 capital came because the Fed had kind of pinned interest rates at zero. And for the type of trading we were doing, that diminished the volatility in the marketplace, which meant our returns were not, they were positive. We always made money for people, but they weren't spectacular enough. And my partner is a bit younger than me. They, based on the way the comp structure worked, it was an inefficient place for them to be working.
Understood.
So we ended up sending people's money back, closing it up. So that's like 2013. And at that point, I'm 53 and figured, you know what, I've had enough of working with people. And, you know, I never felt like I really worked for anybody, but, you know, I guess we always work for somebody. And so, for the last 8 years, I've been puttering around doing my own stuff and reading and watching my family grow up and trying to be a good person. And
yeah, totally successful at all on all counts.
That's nice of you to say. Thank you.
Now, you mentioned interest rates pegged at zero.
Yeah,
and that same situation as today.
I think so. You know, I'm very particular. I've been accused of being very particular. The situation we have now, obviously, is unlike anything we've experienced in our lifetime and really ever in humanity, right? Because I know there have been pandemics, but never with the financial system such as we have now.
Right.
So, And when we say interest rates, in this instance, we're talking about the overnight rate, the federal funds rate, and pinned means they keep it between zero and 25 basis points. But this is the inside baseball part. They're doing this thing called quantitative easing, where they're going and they're injecting reserves into the banking system. Arguably, that's a way to sort of make the interest rates effectively lower than zero because they've oversupplied reserves to the banking system.
And the goal of that is to encourage spending, lending money?
Oh, it's there's a lot of things. The first step, and in this instance, let's talk about the environment we're in, right? Because it's most important. In March, when people figured out there was a problem and the markets were collapsing, there were liquidity crises.
Okay.
So the first objective was to provide liquidity to the financial system to keep it from seizing up, people panicking, you know, keep the gears of the machine running,
Okay.
So they accomplished that, and kudos to them. I mean, you know, you can say a lot of things about the prior administration, and I'm always trying to be apolitical when I do these chats with people.
Yep.
But the amount of money they put into the financial system, you know, unquestionably was of such a magnitude, they made sure there wasn't going to be a problem.
Okay.
Did it go to all the right places at all the right time and all the right circumstances? No, but there was just no way to do it. But what they right. did was they stemmed the catastrophe, right?
Okay. So that's so, Jay Powell and the Fed and their policy being proactive or in a reactive, but that they did the right thing in your opinion.
They did, but also keep in mind it had Congress passed the fiscal stuff, right?
Okay.
And Treasury gave the Fed authority to have lending programs, so it was all hands on deck.
Okay.
Okay. Yep. You may love or hate the commander in chief, but at the end of the day, they did what they needed to do. Full stop. Okay. So that's how we got to zero in terms of interest rates, right? So why are they still here? Well, they're still here because you've taken this machine, and as a friend of mine said, you've got this machine, you threw sand in the gears. Now, you know, it's going to take a little more than a couple of months worth of oil in the gears to get this thing back running again. And so that's why we're going to see rates at zero for, you know, a number of years, and the Fed is going to continue to provide liquidity through quantitative easing, I think, for an extended period of time.
For the foreseeable future. And until they reach a certain level of inflation, that they're going to keep them pegged at zero?
They've said that they have a dual mandate, but what they've adjusted is the dual mandate is employment and prices.
Okay.
So they've had this job of having full employment with stable prices, but now they've adjusted the inflation element to say that inflation has been running too low for too long, and the number that they are looking for is 2%. So they would like to average 2%,
right?
So once again, I'm no good with math, but if you've been running under, you got to run over, right?
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, if you look at the unemployment statistics, I think it's hard, but not impossible, but it's hard to generate substantial inflation with so many people out of work. And why is that? Well, you know, when you've got something, there's two components. There's labor and parts, right?
Yep.
Well,
yep.
If there's people looking for work, the price of labor shouldn't go up. The price of parts, I think, is going up. I've seen some instances. My son-in-law is in a manufacturing business. He showed me the price of steel and stuff is going up.
Yep.
I've done some shopping on Amazon, and you know, it's subtle inflation. Like these slippers I wanted that in gray. Well, they didn't have them in my size in gray, so I bought them in green. Well,
okay.
You know, it pays the same, right? But I mean, I couldn't get what I wanted, right?
So
if you look at certain things that the wealthy people like and haven't been affected, and if anything, they may be slightly better off financially because of the asset price increase. So like high-end things like high-end real estate, high-end jewelry.
Can't get it. Can't touch it.
Yep. I mean, the prices are going up. I mean, I live in Greenwich, right?
Yep.
You could not give a house away in Greenwich, you know, 18 months ago.
Of course. Yeah. Same New Canaan. There's every other house is for sale.
Yeah. Now there was something in the paper today. I think, I forget where I saw it, but it said 14% of the houses selling in Greenwich are trading above the asking price.
Yep.
I mean,
that even sounds low to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So
houses are selling in a day in Westchester. If you put your house for sale in Westchester, you're going to get 9 offers for over list, and it's sold within 48 hours.
Yeah. So there does seem to be inflation. Just to kind of go along this theme with the Fed and money and the circulation, I say these things, and they probably sound a little Yogi Berra-ish. But maybe like him, maybe they can be distilled down to something which makes some sense. But my comment has been, the people who don't need the money don't need the money. And the people who do need the money really need the money. So for the rich guys who are, and once again, please, I want to get a pass on not always saying the human loss and the human suffering. I mean, I get, we've been touched. We have friends. We have close friends have died. And none of this minimizes that, right? But that's not the purpose of this discussion, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the wealthy people, they have assets. The prices of their assets are going up, okay? Because the Fed has made interest rates low and has said they're going to stay low. So the rich are getting richer. And the average guy, either their business is closed or they've got the kids at home, and so mom can't work because she's got to watch the kids, or dad can't work because dad's got to watch the kid, So this wealth divide that was a problem to begin with is being exacerbated.
Yep. Ray Dalio said today, Ray Dalio of Bridgewater came out and said, the one question that I want the current administration to address is the situation between the wealth gap and what's going on in the country with regards to that. So he basically echoed what you said, or you echoed what he said, in the sense that, the rich are getting richer. The people that are hurting are on life support.
Yeah. And, that's a tough one. So, I like to kind of tap the glass, as they say. So, once again, this just happens to be a Democrat. Mm-hmm. If it were a Republican, it'd be the same story. But I saw today that Nancy Pelosi's husband bought millions of dollars worth of stock options on Apple, Tesla,
Facebook.
Okay. Now, look, there's no reason to believe that the Pelosi family has any inside information into those companies. Okay?
Right. Yep.
I'm saying, hey, everybody thought they were going up and they jumped on the bandwagon.
Yep.
But the optics suck.
Agreed.
And Nancy Pelosi, if she's not 80, she can spit to 80.
Yep.
So I'm guessing her husband's in the same neck of the woods, right? And I've read somewhere that her net worth's like $100 million.
Yep.
What? How much is enough?
Yeah.
You tell me. I mean, a hondo? You can live pretty.
Yeah, I think that's enough.
Okay. So
at 80, I think at 80, for me, I'm 39. A hondo would get me to retirement, and then I can collect Social Security, and that'll get me, that'll bridge the gap. Who knows what that's,
Well, with inflation, 100 might just get you
right.
There, right?
Exactly.
No, but you see my point.
Absolutely.
So Ray Dalio, who, by the way,
nobody's listening.
The point is how are you going to get the Congress to say, well, this is how we're going to do stuff, when you have the Speaker of the House whipping around, million dollar blocks of stock options. I mean, come on, physician, heal thyself. So fuck you.
Okay. Yeah. Understood. 100%. So, trading options and the prices, you touched on Apple, Tesla, Facebook. Give me your thoughts on the market as it is today at these record highs with unemployment where it is and the asset prices where they are?
Well, I mean, look, I don't know.
There's a lot of money sloshing around.
See, so on one hand, you have a wall of money.
Okay.
Right? You're Irish, so you're familiar with boats in the ocean, right? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got a wall of money equivalent to like a 100-foot wave.
Yep.
Okay. And in front of that wave is this total clusterfuck of an economy, right? It's just, there's a Japanese word for it, but this is a PG audience, so I won't use it. But the stuff is really bad. So you have these competing forces. Is the wall of money gonna fix everything? And the problem is, we've already said, is it's making the wealthy wealthier,
mm-hmm.
and it ain't helping the little guy.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know how that's going to play out.
Okay.
And now, one thing I've learned the hard way is, there's three positions you can have in the market. You can be long, you can be short, and you can be flat.
Okay.
And in my world, flat is a position too. Okay. So when I get to the point where I don't understand things,
mm-hmm.
I get flat.
Understood.
And so I have a speculation, as you know, in precious metals. And mm-hmm. that's for me. That's not for anybody mm-hmm. else. Meaning I'm not going to give you the
sure.
my sales pitch on that, because I don't care what you do in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's just sitting in treasury bills. And
yeah.
and why? The reason is because you have this huge unemployment. So the question remains in my mind, what's going to happen with inflation? Equal or more importantly, what are the taxes situation going to be like? And so, because if you've looked at your paycheck, you see that a large chunk of what you earn goes to the government, right?
Yep.
So I've found that if you can minimize the amount of taxes you pay, the more you get to keep. Sounds pretty simple, right? So when you look at different kinds of investments, they have different ways they're taxed. And I think one thing everybody agrees on is the tax rates and the taxes are going to change. So I'm happy between the question about inflation and what's going to happen with income taxes to say, I'll just sit here and let everyone thrash themselves. And I'll wait to see which way it goes.
Yeah.
And so I don't mind waiting, which yeah. is, you know, when you're 60, it's easier to do than when you're 40 or 30 or 20. When I was in my 20s, I mean, I couldn't be happier than sitting writing tickets all day.
Okay.
Now, you know, I don't like writing tickets.
Right.
I mean, I like it, but I know that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I like making more money more than I like writing tickets. So
you have no FOMO. That's not bothering you, sitting and watching this go up and up and up to record highs.
Oh, I look, I'm human.
Okay.
Fuck, it'd be great to roll in the morning and make a couple hundred grand or whatever your number is and say, mm-hmm. yeah, look what I did today.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understand that, as they say in one of the books I recommend people read, I found I make my big money sitting on my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've got an idea about how I think the metals are going to play out, which we could talk about another time, but
yep.
I think that's a unique opportunity. And so it serves a dual purpose. One is it gives me something to think about, something to focus on, and it keeps me from farting around in the GameStop, Bed Bath & Beyond, Bitcoin, Ethereum. Oh. You talked about the levels of the market, and you know, I've been around long enough that you learn all these terms, right? So puts, calls, open interest, short interest, moving average, momentum, mm-hmm. growth versus value. These metrics look fucked up to me.
Okay.
You look at the ratios of puts to calls, if you look at the volume of options, this whole phenomenon of the no commissions, that to me is like,
yeah, Robin Hood. Yeah.
You know, there was a, I'll try and keep this not vulgar, but there was a meme going around years ago that people convinced each other that oral sex wasn't sex.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, whoever convinced people of that, he's the guy that convinced people that you can trade stocks commission free.
Okay. Yep.
Fortunately, I was too old for both of those, but maybe you can edit that one out.
Right. It's just to me, I mean, you mentioned GameStop, even Bitcoin, where if you looked at the charts and you say to yourself, this just doesn't make sense compared to what's going on Main Street or how these things are moving.
Mm-hmm.
We could spend an hour talking about that GameStop situation, but that just to me is an example of how irrational the market is, where a guy like you could look and say, all right, this is crazy. You would, it's the number one shorted, stock on the exchange.
Yeah. It's funny. I couldn't spend an hour talking about it because it's ludicrous.
It's ludicrous.
So another ludicrous example was Hertz stock filed for bankruptcy, perfect. Right? And the bankruptcy judge made some comment about, it's like, no one ever, you don't come into bankruptcy court talking about the value of the equity. You're here because you've acknowledged the equity is zero.
Yep.
I mean, I don't even know where the stock is, where it trades, this or that, but it's like, I got to look myself in the mirror. Like, I picked up the phone and traded Hertz stock, I was banging around GameStop. I mean, I don't know. I got 2 degrees. I'm not in.
So who's doing this? Who's doing that? When that happens on Friday, is that Robinhood retail?
Yeah, it's got.
That is.
I don't know, but what I did read was last quarter, Robinhood got paid $180 million by hedge funds to direct their order flow, meaning the Robinhood clients put orders in, and Robinhood took those orders and gave it to a hedge fund to execute them.
Front run them?
Well, sell them the stock at a shittier price, right?
Okay,
And Robinhood, as the broker or accomplice, perhaps, got paid a fee. So, this notion that it's like, oh, I'm trading stock for free, no.
Yeah.
By the way, when I traded government bonds, which I did for 30-something years, mm-hmm. The bulk of my trading, I never paid a commission. It's because you got what they called was the bid-offer spread.
Yep.
Like if you were at Salomon and I was at the Aubrey Lansdon and I said, hey, Liam, I need to sell you 5 million long bonds, and you would say 13. And I would say, well, they're 13 bid at 15, meaning 13 is a little low, 15 would be high. If I sold them to you at 13, that's your commission. You're getting them on the bid side, right?
Got it.
Or if you called me and said, and B, I want to buy some, I would say, well, 15. Well, that there's no commission. You had to pay a higher price.
Yep, understood.
So that's what's going on with the Robinhood guys, or even E-Trade, Charles yep. Schwab.
Yep.
You know, whoever. I don't even know all the names anymore.
No, those are the players.
But,
yeah.
But that's there's no free commission. I mean,
yeah.
Who's going to pay for the hookers and cocaine?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Critical aspect.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about that stuff, though. I want to bother you about Bitcoin. I want to bother you about Tesla. I want to ask you about the Robinhood effects on the market, because I would think a couple years ago that wouldn't move a market like that, where it wasn't a serious force to be reckoned with, but it seems like it is now.
Okay. Well, let me give you a 90-second answer.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I don't want to leave you hanging in this regard, but in a lot of respects, the market's broken.
Okay.
So, I can give you a list of what I mean by that, but
we've got a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
The short answer is the market's broken because there's been a lot of regulation placed on the banks in terms of the types of inventory they can carry. So you don't have great pricing mechanisms. The regulations have been loosened such that you have a ton of people trading options now that probably don't understand the risks involved. The markets are very thin. So a lot of these new companies that IPO, there's not a lot of liquidity to them. The mm-hmm. The reason Bitcoin moves so much is because I think that the amount of available float, meaning mm-hmm. how much there is out there to trade, is small. It's difficult to short. I don't even know how you short it, but I'm sure you can find a way. And then in the Bitcoin, the processing is kind of slow. Meaning I know if you trade a stock, you get a fill instantaneously. With the Bitcoin, there's got to be some matching up to make sure it's valid and you own it. And so you have all these things working across purposes. And with the amount of money sloshing around, stuff moves pretty quickly. So I could give you a more detailed answer on each one in particular.
No, you answer my question. What I wanted to get out of you was the answer that the market is broken in some sense.
Yeah.
And that's why you're flat.
That's why I'm flat. But just to define the reason of flat is, and this is more for the professional trader than the average guy, but so let's say I had a hunch the market was going up, and so I'd be long. Well, if I'm wrong, okay, not only can't I be short, I got to move out of my long position to flat before I can get short, right?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, one of the things I know now is when this thing turns, and it may not turn for 5 years, but when it goes, there's no get me out. It'll be discontinuous and you're stuck. So it's much easier to trade from a flat position and risk some upside versus the getting stuck and having to get out of something you don't want.
Okay. All right. Well, we talked about Bitcoin and I'm going to do my homework and I'm going to do a little bit of preparation so I can ask you about that, because I've got a lot of questions and I know you probably don't have the answers, but talking about it, I think is fascinating.
I, you know, not knowing something's never stopped me from not talking
right.
about it.
Same here. Yeah. That's why we get along great. So.
Boom. Yep. All right.
All right, buddy. So I'll do my homework and I look forward to talking to you soon.
So why don't we, talk next Sunday.
Yep. Okay, great.
I look forward to it.
Thank you, Morris.
Great to see you. Take care, Liam.
Bye now.
Bye.